I hope you like my title. In any case, I think that everybody here is an expert, but I will make a very brief introduction, and then I will go to my conclusions, so everybody knows the conclusions from the beginning, and then I will justify the conclusion. The first is atmospheric neutrinos. So I have here a pretty picture of an atmospheric cascade. Now, the atmospheric cascade, the only thing that I will be concerned about are the leptons that come in the cosmic air showers. So here you have a proton or a nucleon, actually, and it interacts with a nucleus, a nucleon, in a nucleus in the atmosphere, and it produces a cascade of particles. Up to energies of about maybe 100 TeV, 10 TeV, lower than a TeV, the muons and neutrino fluxes are dominated by conventional sources, that means pions and kaons, the case of pions and kaons. But at higher energies, at these energies already at TeV and so, pions and kaons start interacting before decaying. And since the fluxes are so steep, they become subdominant. And therefore, even a small, the very small fraction of very short-lived particles, which are charm particles mostly at these energies, this decays of short-lived particles becomes dominant. And those are the prompt muons and neutrinos. Those arise mostly from the semi-leptonic decay of charm particles. Now, there is really, so this is a part prompt atmospheric. Why am I saying the recycling of the neutrino telescope waste? Neutrino telescopes, well, there are several underwater, under ice, kilometer cube detectors, which are being, well, there are prototypes constructed and so on. I will use some pretty pictures that I took from Amanda only, simply because I have the pictures and they have the best pictures. So this is Amanda, as you very well know. So these are instrumented, these are photomultipliers, longer strings of photomultipliers. This is the Amanda 2 detector as it is now. You see that it gets about to between 2 and 3 kilometers of water equivalent. Well, this is water actually, because this is in ice. And why is that I'm saying that I want to use the neutrino telescope waste? Because they are using two types of signal. You may have seen, as I said, these are just pretty pictures that I took from Amanda sites. So you see that, for example, here, how is it they see a signal from neutrinos in these neutrino telescopes? They see mostly the neutrinos coming through the Earth, right? So neutrino mu produces a muon through charge current interaction close to in or close to the detector, and you see the muon coming, the muon passing through. And so this is the main, one of the two main signals. They are up-moving neutrinos, not down, up-moving muons produced by neutrinos, and not, where is this, how do you,
it's okay.
Oh, here, it's okay? Okay.
The problem is that you're staying a bit.
So this is mostly the signal that they had until recently. You see that actually you see from the South Pole, you see the Northern Hemisphere. Right, so they are up moving with respect to, so down moving would be coming this way, and so they see essentially the Northern Hemisphere, and this is between the horizontal and vertically up. Now recently they have added another type of signals that they keep, a signal, which is the cascades. Here with this type they have a much a bigger coverage, because what they do is to reconstruct the neutrino-initiated cascade. So they can do it only for cascades that are, they have this sort of fireball very close to the detector. They have many different tracks. They see, of course, light coming out, essentially, from the muons and so on. And they reconstruct the cascades. Now, this has the advantage that actually they have a complete coverage, at least for energies which are below TeV, because then 100 TeVs when the neutrinos are absorbed, passing through the Earth, and therefore only the neutrino tau would be there. But essentially, they throw out all the cosmic rays, the muon directly produced in the atmosphere, that are coming from above, right? So the only muons, the only atmospheric muons, come from above. They muons cannot penetrate from through the Earth. They have only a few kilometers path through the Earth. And those for all these kilometer cube detectors, Amanda, the preliminary experiments and so on, they are a background that they reject. And I would like precisely to use those. So while the neutrinos come from everywhere, and therefore they are an irreducible background for any diffuse cosmogenic neutrinos, which is actually one of the main signals that they want to study, the muons, the atmospheric muons, come only from above. Now, so far they have been not keeping those, in particular because here I wanted to show you, for example, these are some signals they are expecting from diffuse. This is Waxman and Bacall, this is another model. And these are different limits from diffuse fluxes. And you see that they are concerned about where the atmospheric muons would be dominated by prompt muons, in fact. This is, but the uncertainty in the flux of atmospheric neutrinos becomes dominated by the prompt flux much before. So already at the TeV, as we will see, is about 10%. The uncertainty is about 10%, which is the level of uncertainty of conventional neutrinos. And then it becomes more dominant, more dominant, more dominant. At this point, there is about two order of magnitude uncertainty in the level. Please interrupt me if I am... Here there are some... This is another, my last pretty picture from all this that I got from... Amanda, and as you see there, there are different fluxes. There are different fluxes here. These are the lines and different lines. And really, in order to understand if you are seeing how much you are seeing of a particular extra terrestrial source, cosmogenic source, you will need to understand the background of atmospheric neutrinos. Put this pretty picture there. Now, this is
are all those atmospheric neutrinos prompt?
Well, these are conventional, and the prompt ones are mostly due to charm. These are not becoming important until much later.
But the non-prompt ones, the ones
that... No, the non-prompt ones, the conventional, there is a crossover here. Here you see, this is the E-cube. It's an E-cube weighted collection of computational fluxes. So here you have the conventional. At this point, there is about the 30% uncertainty in the conventional. These are the ones that actually are seeing, you know, from Super Kamiokande and so on. Yeah, much earlier. The neutrinos mu are about the tenth of the muons from conventional sources. The neutrino electrons are another order of magnitude lower.
What is the prompt in your plot?
The prompts are all the colored ones. This is from Sass and Halson. This is already, but Sass and Halson did at some point a very rough model of the charm production, really wanting to be breaking whatever models from above and from the bottom. These are actually bounds, actual ones from LVDF, from Akeno array. So you see that this is rejected, this upper, but they intended it as an upper bound. These are models not based in perturbative QCD. In fact, until about 10 years ago, both the calculations of perturbative QCD, there was only the leading order calculation, not the next to leading order calculation of charm production or any heavy flavor production. And so both the quality of the data of production on fixed targets and the quality of the calculations were bad enough that people had a lot in mind, plenty of different type of models that were models of the type with one with which one treats the S quarks, which are much lighter. Perturbative QCD wouldn't work on those.
I'm confused. What is this plotting? Is this the downward flux?
This is the downward
of
the flux.
That's
of everything that is indicated. This is the vertical going down. I didn't put this, this would have been too crowded. For the conventionals, there is a very large azimuthal angle dependence. It becomes this is vertically down, and it becomes practically one order of magnitude down from the horizontal direction. For the prompt, there is practically no change because it is prompt still in, from each side of the atmosphere. Now, these bands here, this belongs, this is Pasquale Rino-Sarcevich, and this is Gelmini Gondolo-Varieschi. I will mainly talk about these bands. These are calculations that are due to, based on perturbative QCD calculations, next to leading order perturbative QCD calculations.
And what's the input? What's the incoming flux that is used in these calculations?
I'll tell you in a second.
Like you said, the same? Or?
Yes, for at least for these two are the same. For this is a little different.
So I forgot, what is the input for the highest one?
Yeah. Sincerely, I don't even remember, but they were really very exaggerated ones. They knew that. They said, well, let us do something outrageously high, outrageously low. I do not remember, but it's not really realistic. Sincerely, I don't remember. I didn't review that. This is far away from. In any case, so these are essentially what I will try to argue on, because I know Paul needs to leave, so I'm just saying my conclusions beforehand. First of all, if you go to these energies above 10 to the 5 GeVs, I will show that actually these uncertainties in the QCD calculations, perturbative QCD calculations, are dominated by the uncertainty in the gluon PDF, in the density of gluons within a proton for x smaller than what has been measured. So we don't have the data, we don't have the perturbative, the data coming mostly from Hera. And so actually I would say that we could measure or at least have some idea of the gluon PDF by studying the fluxes of muons, actually. It's much easier because there are so many more coming down. Muons, downgoing muons. In particular, I will argue that while the uncertainty, and we studied all the uncertainties, the theoretical uncertainties, the uncertainty in the level goes to orders of magnitude, the uncertainty in the slope of the gluon PDF is actually much smaller. So one could measure the slope of the gluon PDF at x reaching maybe 10 to the minus 7. Now, is it worth doing in this unclean way? Probably yes, because not even LHC will get lower than about 10 to the minus 5. So whatever indication we can get may be worth exploring.
You're saying you can measure the slope?
The slope.
Without measuring,
well, the level is related to the PDF itself. The slope is related to the slope. The error in the slope, the uncertainty of the slope is much smaller. So you can have a nice determination of the slope.
Without knowing the.
Well, independently of the level of the level itself. It happens many times in astrophysics, actually, that the level of a particular flux, astrophysical flux, actually is very uncertain, but the slope is much better, a much better indication. Yeah.
By the slope, you mean what reflects into the power law of the cross section?
It would be, by slope I mean x, g of x, the parametrization is x to the minus lambda, this lambda. This feeds directly, as I will show, the slope of the muons, of actually muons of neutrinos, because they are the same, neutrino, electron, neutrino, mu, the slope of the prompt atmospheric leptons is direct, is linear in this lambda slope of the PDF. This would be where, in the range where prompt atmospheric leptons dominate over conventional. But what I will argue also, this is well known, is that the prompt atmospheric neutrinos dominate the uncertainty in the atmospheric background, even at energies which are much lower. So the atmospheric, the conventional ones, are known within 30%. They will be known soon, that's the promise, within 10%. And as you see here, even taking the LVD upper limit here, you see that actually already at about 1 TeV, at here, the atmospheric, the prompt neutrinos could be 10% of the conventional ones. So they dominate the uncertainty already at 1 TeV. And therefore, I would say that actually we can use the muons in order to measure the neutrinos. What we are interested in is in the neutrino background, and you can measure it in two ways. Either you measure the neutrinos themselves, and this is what, for example, Amanda 2 is trying to do now. But what we are suggesting is to actually use the muons, because, and I will argue this, the fluxes of muons and neutrinos coming from CHARM in the atmosphere are identical, within 10%. And this is due to the kinematics of the CHARM decays and the properties of the CHARM decay. We realize this just by doing it, but actually it's independent of the CHARM production. And, you know, and so you could use, you could measure the flux of the downgoing muons at sea level. They are the same as the atmospheric neutrinos. So this is a complementary, it has its own complications, because this is a region in which you will need to separate the prompt from the conventional. The conventional still dominates, and you will need to separate it. And there are ways, people have studied ways in which you can separate, essentially because of the different zenith angle dependence. Are my conclusions clear? So now I will go through my, I will go through my exam, through my.
At 10 to the 3 GeV there, it seems to me that the conventional is 3 orders of magnitude higher.
It depends what you take or what you believe,
well,
right?
If you take perturbative.
If you take perturbative, you see it will be much smaller. But if you take the LVD, some people actually are extremely in love with these models still. They still say, well, perturbative QCD, CHARM, it's too light. Maybe there are intrinsic CHARM components. They cannot be excluded. And stuff like that, and so, you know, they don't believe perturbative QCD in particular. Francis Haltzman, for example, is one of them, so actually, you know, it's not only the people who actually generated these models that are in love with this model. So these are, I'm not sure if I would, I should go through all these names of different, but these models, the QSM, or the RQPM. These are models, they are called core gluon string model based on Rechen's asymptotics. RQPM is a recombination quark parton model. This is in intrinsic CHARM and so on. And these are the authors. Let me go a little bit through the history. Do I have a clock here? Okay. Experimental searches, so the estimates of the prompt fluxes differ by two orders of magnitude. Experimental searches are inconclusive. They have a large systematics, and they get only to this little region. You see, this is a picture that I took from Misaki, Sinegovsky, and Takahashi, who have been very interested in measuring underwater muon fluxes. They have computed this. These blue are the models that I will mostly talk about, which are my work with Gondolo and Varieschi. These are INAS points, PRS. And these are other models, these other two models, which are phenomenological models, not based in perturbative dysidia. Here are the data. The data are really inconclusive. So now you have to sort of rely on calculations. And as I said, perturbative dysidia was thought to be inadequate to sculpture production until about 10 years ago. What happens is that the next two leading order it adds a factor of two, essentially a factor of two to the cross sections. And this is because you add a very important diagram which was not present, which is not present in leading order in charm production, which is gluon-gluon. Two gluons going to two gluons. Two gluons going to two gluons, and then one of the two gluons generates. Now, this diagram is very important. And this is present in next to leading order, and it's not present in the other, the leading order ones, which are, you know, something like this, and things like this, and so on and so forth. Also with quarks in principle, okay? But the quarks are subdominant, as I will show in a moment. However, of course, the data. Now, perturbative QCD predictions and experiments are now known to be compatible where the data are, which are 250 GVs. Now, I will extrapolate to, you know, several orders of magnitude to 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 8 GVs. So the extrapolation was really introduce large uncertainties.
And that's because, of course, of nucleons, but most of these interactions presumably are occurring off of oxygen and nitrogen and so forth.
Well, then let me, I will comment on that in a second. Why did we get in all this? I'll return to this in a moment. Tumman, Engelmann, and Gondolo, TIG, this paper, I referred to that, the TIG, in 1996, produced the first computation based in QCD, but they took the leading order charm production. They multiplied by a factor of two, which was known approximately to get into agreement with the next two leader calculation. This this diagram actually introduces a factor of two, essentially, in the cross section. You don't expect that higher orders will introduce as much of a change. Okay, so this is this. The fact that the next two leading order is so much larger than the leading order doesn't mean really that there is a breakdown of the perturbative expansion. It means only that this diagram enters and was not there before. It's actually very important. So we decided, together with Paolo Gondolo and Gabriele Varieschi, to understand better the estimates of TIG. What was really very intriguing for us is that the estimate of TIG, here you have TIG, was much lower than all the other evaluations up to this point. And we wanted to understand why QCD was producing these very low fluxes. And actually, we did understand that, but in any case, so we started, actually, we used the same, decided to use the same programs that I use in the colliders, collider physics. The Mangano, Nasson, and Ridolfi program that actually incorporates the next two leading order perturbative calculation to charm production, B production also, and so on. This is what is used, for example, in the calculations for the LHC. And a full atmospheric cascade simulation with Pythia, which is also something that is used. Now, when we were writing our first paper, saying that the K values were between 2.2 and 2.4, and so on and so forth. Actually, we saw this paper by Pasquale, Reno, and Sarcevic. They also had concluded that actually the K factors were the same, but they obtained a bit higher values. I will talk essentially about these papers we have written now. Four papers between 1999 and now, mostly 1999 to 2001. We all, both Pasquale, Rino, Sarcevic, Gelmini, Gondola, Varieschi, we used, and TIG, we used the same evaluation. This was somebody asked for the input flux. This is it. So we use protons or proton equivalent. Otherwise, we studied afterwards the uncertainty into that, which is not bad. As you see, actually, it is 2.7. This is multiplied by 2.7. So it's 2.7, and then it becomes 3 at the knee. So it's not a bad approximation. So we all use the same input. And this factor gamma, I want to show you this gamma, okay, is the factor that tells the slope of the incoming protons. I will talk about this factor gamma in a moment. And we study the uncertainties introduced by different choices. Now, we actually did the fit to the experimental data. We did it ourselves because we wanted to reproduce the total cross-sections and all the cross-sections, right, the differential cross-sections, with the same set of parameters. Of course, there are several parameters in this calculation. One is MC, the mass of the charm. The other is mu F, the factorization scale, the renormalization scale. And so we did this, and you see that actually the agreement is rather all right. The only thing is that the data, here there is a piece of information at 600 GV, but they are mostly concentrated at low energies, and we are going to extrapolate farther out. So at the beginning, we did several trials, different knobs that you can, different choices that you can make, that you can do with Pythia. And we saw that they were really very small. All the effects were mostly 10% effects in the fluxes. So they were really irrelevant. So we used the single, which means you put only one charm in Pythia, and then you multiply by 2 instead of having CC bar, which is much more complicated. But I would like you to draw your attention here. This is a bit small, but you see, these are the QQ, so this type of QQ going to CC, you see, that they are subdominant. This is the flux. Okay, this is the E cube weighted flux. And these are the contributions of the flux on different channels, different diagrams. And you see that the contribution of quarks, so quark-quark annihilation going to CC bar, is much smaller than the contribution of gluons. So the cross-section is dominated by gluon fusion. So, and the reason... Oh, we also computed, let me show you already here, we also computed the KL, you see these factors, which is just the next to leading order divided by the leading order cross-section. You see this is from muons, neutrinos, and electrons. Already you can see here by eye that the production is practically identical, right? This is... And moreover, you can see that actually TIC has taken 2. We find between 2.2 and 2.4. These are all 10% effects. So what was the reason of TIC being so small? Well, the issue is that precisely that the fluxes are dominated by the gluon PDF. And Pythia has an automatic choice, which they didn't even realize it was doing, that when there are no data for x less than 10 to the minus 4, Pythia takes an extrapolation of the gluon PDF, x g of x to the minus lambda, which is very, for lambda, could be between 0.1 and 0.5, and Pythia takes among the smallest values. Pythia takes among the smallest values, and others, you see here, we took different sets of PDFs, MRS, R1, R2. Finally, when we were in our third paper or something, MRST appeared, so we use MRST. But you see that actually it depends. So they took a very small value of lambda. Essentially, this is the result, why the result is so low. Now, let me say why is that the gluons, one can understand immediately why gluons dominate. So the incoming flux is very steep, right? So in order to produce leptons that count. You cannot lose much energy in the production. So actually, the dominant contribution to the flux comes from charm quarks, which are produced with a large fraction of the incoming momentum of the quark. So the incoming momentum of the quark, which I call x1 here, is of order 0.1. We did it better, actually. You can see that this 0.1, between 1.1 and 0.2. So it's of order 10 to the minus 1. It's relatively large. On the other, the typical partonic center of mass is close to the CC bar threshold. This is simply because the differential cross-section, d sigma ds hat, actually decreases with increasing s hat. So the dominant production occurs at threshold. So s hat, square root of s hat, is twice the mass of the charm. On the other hand, the total center of mass energy squared is s, which is 2 mass of the nucleon e. This is 1 GV. So this is this essentially the same thing. And so now you can say that what is x1, x2 now is the momentum fraction of the target in the atmosphere. And this is s hat over s. And so you see that this is GV over E. E is the energy of the incoming nucleon. So you see what is X2? X2 is GV, so you pass X1 down. X1 is 0.1. So X2 is of order GV divided by 0.1 E, which is about the energy of the C, which is about the energy of the relevant leptons. As soon as you lose much energy in the processes, you are competing with other much, with a much higher, lower energy flux. So as soon as you lose energy, those leptons are subdominant. So the dominant contribution comes from X2, which is of order GV over the lepton energy. Here is what comes, this is my comment about composition. One, you have to worry that if you go to X, so I'm going to go to energies which go up to maybe 10 to the 8 GV. Above 10 to the 8, you don't have enough flux to see anything in a kilometer cube detector. And so I will go to X, X2, which are further even 10 to the minus 8. And of course, even if the HERA data can be accounted for without saturation unitarities, shadowing effects, all these concerns, as soon as you go above, you will have them. The only thing I can say is that these effects will affect the atmosphere, but not the incoming cosmic ray, because in the incoming cosmic ray, the dominant contribution comes from relatively large X. And so it will not be these effects, when once they are understood, will be affecting the nuclei in the atmosphere, which we know of which we know the composition, and it is not affected by the composition of the cosmic rays. Now we didn't include them, and they can even eliminate. They can make the results that I'm giving even 30% smaller at an energy about 10 to the 7 GV. They could also change a bit the slope, the effective slope of the gluon PDF. And we haven't included them.
How far down will the LHC probe?
The LHC will not probe much farther. This is an interesting. The LHC will not go. Maybe it will go to 10 to the minus 5, possibly only 10 to the minus 4.
Well, it depends on the measure, right?
It depends on what they measure, because actually. Well, at HERA, it's just Q squared over S. The its limit is that. The LHC, you have the, so X, the larger X, this is the mass of the particle you're measuring, you are tagging, e to the minus rapidity. So the smaller mass, the smaller x is obtained with a smaller mass and the larger rapidity. Now, it is unclear if the charm will be tagged. This is because you have to go very close to the vertex where, you know, there are many more decays of bees than charm. It's very difficult. So if you, if they are able to tag the bees only, then you will get at about 10 to the minus 4 because there is a rapidity, you will not get.
They could do prompt photons, right? You could get prompt photons that went very low in PT, could go below that, depending how low they can identify.
How low they can go?
Well, that's being studied right now. It's clear, but that's a possibility.
That's a possibility. But how do you know how low they could go? 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6?
Well, it depends whether they can separate pi zero decay, photons from pi zero decay. If they can do that, which is difficult at Fermi level,
yeah.
Then potentially they could go to PT of the photon of, let's say, 5 GeV, and that would be 5 GeV divided by root S, so it's 10 to the minus 6. But that's
not clear. Well, so we'll see if this is. It hasn't been completely studied so far.
It's not directly measured.
But this is interesting, actually. This is something new. Okay, so as I said, the gluon PDF is not known right now beyond about 10 to the minus 5. It has not been measured. And so what we did was to extrapolate lambda, to extrapolate it in the gluon PDF. And study what happens actually if you do different extrapolations between 0.1 and 0.5, actually, which are the limits that are there are theoretical limits, you know, on this. Ridge analysis usually gives a very small. This is with the choice of Pythia because of this. But instead, if you have this very large logarithm one over x logarithm, they are called, then the BFKL. Resummation gives lambda, which is much larger. Now, I know which could be one of your questions because we have been asked so many times the same thing.
Could I ask one more question?
Please, yes.
Is the contribution of bottom totally negligible?
Excuse me?
Bottom parts totally negligible?
Yes. Still, yes. It would be.
Harder from bottom, right?
It's much smaller. You produce many less. And they would become dominant at energies which are completely irrelevant for kilometer cubes. I don't know if they will ever be relevant for something, but I remember that we did at the beginning. It's very, very far. But people always say the following. Look, you're using all this machinery which is okay for accelerator physics, but you're using it in the atmosphere. And so can you do that? Well, one I already mentioned is the possible saturation and all that. We haven't taken into account. Actually, it is a very messy. I tried to study. It's very confusing. People don't agree. People even who try to do estimates, they don't agree. It's extremely messy.
People have this collision on a nucleus. That nucleus is just in the rest of the flying particle and the so it's that if you're completely too low on physics, you have this current sheet, this really flat thing that has all kinds of nucleons compressed in that direction.
So you mean that this could be actually much important?
I look at red collisions and see, you know, how different it is from a nucleon nucleus versus nucleon nucleon. And I think you're going to find that we don't understand very much what's going on at red right now. But there are large differences between nucleon 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 nucleus. And it's physically.
It may be very important. Well, maybe we can use the data of Rick, really. Now they are becoming actually much more. It's a nice thing to look at, really. Yes.
I haven't seen the most recent one, but I thought Phoenix was measuring charm, and they did not see much deviation from, they didn't see much shadow. but I'm not sure.
Well, it's a side question, you know.
That is true, that is true. But I thought they were measuring.
Well, before I lose all the audience, let me continue, because otherwise that's too. Okay, in any case, we have done the unitarity of the cross section. Actually, if you compute it like this, you see that actually overcomes, this is about 10 to the 10 GV. It overcomes the total PP cross section. But this we understood, because actually this is the inclusive cross section. You are getting, okay, I'm losing more and more people.
No,
oh, no! Okay, no. In any case, we try to do, there is one, the log of PT over MC. These logs are large in accelerators because the acceptance, the forward acceptance, there is a hole in the acceptance. So you are actually selecting for large PT. But here we are in an experiment with complete coverage. You know, our detector is everywhere, even where the beam is. And so when you consider the total cross-section, not the cat in rapidity, actually, in PT, then you see that the PT, the dominant PT, is of order GV. So these are not large logarithms. So in this case, we're better. We're doing better. Then there is this, which are called the logarithms of 1 over x. Actually, they are logarithms square root of s over mc. And we were really concerned about those. Those are the ones that are resummed in. I mentioned before the resummation techniques and so on. We did the following, which shows that the next to leading order is in general not dominated by these logs. We did the following test. Sigma next to leading order minus leading order divided by the leading order, just to give the order of magnitude, and the logarithm. So if this R is constant, it means the next to leading order is dominated by the terms. That means this difference is dominated by terms that contain this logarithm. And therefore, the ratio becomes constant. It becomes essentially order sigma leading order over sigma leading order is constant. But if R decreases, it is not, right? The logarithms increase, and this does not increase. So if R decreases, that means the next to leading order is fine. It's not dominated by these logarithms. These logarithms are not becoming important. So if you keep your energies up to here, 10 to the 9, which is actually 10 to the 8 or so in the energy of the leptons, you see that you are fine, that the next to leading order is never, the logarithms do not dominate. If you go to higher energies, which we are not going to go now, because 10 to the 8 is the maximum that you can ever see, you should worry and take only lambda larger than 0.2. Now, this is only a test for the next to leading order. But you can say, well, the higher orders may be dominated, and then you don't know what to do. This is always possible, but actually, the fact that the next to leading order is not dominated is a good indication. Maybe in the future, if these ideas are ever applied, people would have computed already these corrections, you know. So we cannot do any better. But at least we wanted to know if the next to leading order may. So what we decided to do is to explore the changes induced in cross sections. So the calibration procedure. We choose a PDF set. We choose reasonable values. I mean that all our fits are by eye. Okay, we just saw that the things were, but we didn't do anything more elaborated. We choose the set of parameters with which you can get a good fit to both the differential and the total cross sections, but the data are at 250 GV. And then we did our standard choice with the best fits. For example, for MRST, this is our standard choice. But then we decided to see the experimental uncertainty by changing all these values around reasonable values. And then this is what we got. And I think I will skip the many pictures I have and say the results for the level. You see, if you the level depends on lambda by a factor of 10, that I will probably show, depends on the initial cosmic ray flux by a factor of 5, the composition at the knee mostly, the uncertainty in the composition. Depends on the choice of mu f between the transfer mass over 2 and twice the transfer mass, so reasonable values, and depends on MC between the values of MC between 1.1 and 1.4. You can take 1.5 also GV by a factor of 2. And the PDF depends very small, but really the PDFs are all in agreement. So these two are the dominant ones. Maybe I will show you only these two. So you see that this is what we did in for our normalization of the cross section. These are different bands of mu f, and then mu c increases. This is for each line is for one different mu c, and mc, the mass of the charm quark increases within each band. You see that this gives an order of magnitude uncertainty even for with a fixed lambda. This has a fixed lambda. This order of magnitude uncertainty you see in the resulting fluxes. Here you are. You see in the resulting fluxes, right? So there is an order of magnitude. This is the E cube again. There's an order of magnitude just in the choice of the factorization scale and the mass of the charm, right? For fixed lambda. This is the most important. I will not talk about the, even if we did, you know, these are different feeds for different data on the composition. Really, it's very badly known, so this introduces, but this introduces a factor of 5 or so uncertainty in the calculation. And here it is, the if you take a standard choices of the other parameters, MC, mu F, mu R, here you see the lambda. This is what is plotted, actually, in the previous one. So you see that these are the conventionals computed by Teague. These are all vertical fluxes. And so you see that actually they become dominant at about maybe 10 to the 6 GVs, something like that. And if you see how far you can go, you can see here how far you can go. These are just the fluxes, the number of muons coming down through the detector. Doesn't mean that you can see all of them or detect all of them, all right? But you can see that this line is 100. These are integrated fluxes. So this is the level of 100 per year in a kilometer cube. This is 10 per year. This is 1 per year. So you can go someplace, maybe someplace here, 10 to the 7. Means you can reach 10 to the minus 7 at most. Okay. So, but the proposal, as I said, is not to really measure the information on the gluon PDF through the level, because you know you have two orders of magnitude. Actually, even for fixed lambda, you have one order of magnitude uncertainty in the level. But the uncertainties in the slope is much smaller. In particular, the slope is linear in lambda and it's linear in gamma. So here you have the dependence. You see, it's pretty linear. This is lambda. This is for two different energies. These are the levels of the fluxes of muons, the muon fluxes. So it's pretty linear. But we checked for non-linearities. That means if you take alpha equal minus, this is the slope, right? E to the minus alpha, the slope of the muons. And so this also is a function of lambda. So if I take it to be a constant, I'm making small mistake. But this is very, very small mistake, which actually is these non-linearities introduce 3%, right? The same thing for gamma. For gamma, it's a bit more complicated. Gamma, you know, is the incoming flux. Of course, you have to take into account that there are errors, okay, in the flux themselves. This is the now the same data, but for the slope, right, for the spectral index. And you see that there are systematic errors, which I would take the difference between the different experiments, and then statistical errors that within each experiment, for example, here is much better. This is what? This is Casamia, for example. So we took sort of statistical and systematics. And also, we saw how much, if we write this alpha as gamma minus lambda plus a coefficient, this coefficient also depends on gamma, but it depends on gamma very little. So it gives a small non-linearity, right? So from the point of view, the dependence on the PDF is really very small. It depends on mu f and mc also, but they are all, you see, in the percentage range. So what we are suggesting, and I will go directly to the conclusions for my first claim, is that we can measure the slope of the gluon. Even if there would be some effects that would be shadowing or whatever, you still will have some kind of a slope. But actually, we need to examine more if really there is a very severe violation of this model directly. In any case, so we could reach 10 to the minus 7 if we measure this slope with all these caveats, and the error could be something like 0.2. So I could see if it is close to 0, close to 0.5, right? But the error is about 0.2. So if the present data actually are 10 to the minus 5 or so, then it may be worth doing something like this. If you can get in the LHC or something to 10 to the minus 7, this will become irrelevant, and then you can actually predict your fluxes much better. Right. Now let me go to my second claim. So the first one was to use downgoing muons to maybe say something of the small x gluon PDF at energies above 100 dV where the prompt muons dominate, right? But now I would like to say, what about current measurements? This is something I copied this from Tom Geiser. This is his summary of his talk on atmospheric neutrino fluxes. And he says, an uncertainty in the level of prompt neutrinos from Chan decay will limit the search for diffuse astrophysical neutrinos. He mentions this again. Here, this nice plot. Again, nu e, nu mu, the prompt comes in. Again, the uncertainty in the level of charm is a potential problem for finding diffuse neutrinos. So this problem is well known. Our contribution only is to say the following. Atmospheric muons reach the detector only from above, and they are thrown out so far. They are only downgoing atmospheric neutrinos. Instead of the atmospheric neutrinos, instead, reach the detector from all directions, and therefore they are an irreducible background. This is what I was saying. The uncertainty in the conventional may be 10% soon, and therefore, there it becomes that actually at energies as low as 1 TeV, you may have your uncertainty in dominated by the prompt neutrinos. Between here at 100 TeV, they dominate the flux, right? There is a crossing over. But already someplace in between, they will become dominant in terms of knowing the flux within 10%, 20%, half, and so on. They become increasingly more and more. And the energy is much lower. So the predictions differ by two orders of magnitude. You need to measure the flux. What do you use? Now, there has been a recent paper, very recent, Hopper, Nunokawa, Perez, and Sukanovich Funkal. This is Renata Sukanovich. Okay, in any case, they studied how to do it using cascades. So cascades are these reconstructed neutrino events. They have to be close enough to the detector that you can actually reconstruct. They assume they're rather strong things. They assume that they can reconstruct the energy of the incoming neutrino within a factor of 2 and things like that. And then they see, they have very neat plots. And of course, they have the problem is the contamination with an astrophysical signal. You cannot disentangle them because they come, they are diffuse, they come from all directions. So you cannot disentangle them. So in 10 years, they assume this comes from their work. They assume two different fluxes, one conventional, the prompt, and then another one that they take to be extragalactic, the Waxman and Bacall one. And they see how is that they can disentangle both of them. And they will need 10 years of data. And their determination, for example, here you have a determination. If they are both important, so their determination depends on how much mixing you have of atmospheric or extragalactic, right? These are two fluxes that they have inputted. This is beta, is the slope, the spectral index, e to the minus beta. Alpha is the magnitude. So they have inputted these two pieces of information, and they have gone through all the reconstruction technique that they are proposing with the neutrinos telescope, and this is what they get after 10 years of data. So what we are proposing instead is to use the promnions. Our observation is this one, which I think has been known in the literature, but people, I don't think anybody really said it so clearly. Here you have nu e over mu coming from CHARM, nu mu over mu coming from CHARM. I have no idea where this is for different PDFs with different lambdas. I have no idea where the lambda, this could be all noise, rubbish, things that I don't understand. I don't have any explanation for this. But in any case, you see that at energies that are below 10 to the 5 GVs, they are, you know, 1.1, the ratio is 1.1. And here it opens up, I mean, this is a region which is not interesting for what we are saying. This region is what is interesting. But in any case, they are equal to within factors of 10%. So why not use the downgoing muons? You have 10 to the 7 downgoing muons for each upcoming muon. And you could save 1 in 10 to the 5 or something at TeVs and still have an impressive statistics to do whatever you want. So this is what we're proposing. The difficulty, and this is under study actually, is that you need to separate the prompt flux. Here you can see, this is the crossing for different lambdas. And you see that actually, it doesn't work when there is a strong contamination in the flux of conventional neutrinos. For the conventional neutrinos, the flux of neutrinos is much smaller than the muons. So you really have to see the prompt fluxes. Huh? And you have to be able to disentangle the prompt fluxes in the region of energies where they are not dominant. So there are different ways in this sense. Sinegovskaya and Sinegovskaya and Sinegovsky. I even asked my Russian friend, he didn't even know how to pronounce this, if it is Sinegovskaya or Sinegovskaya. So I guess that I'm allowed to make mistakes. He didn't know. Okay. In any case, they study different ways. I have very nice, pretty pictures. I'm not sure I want to go because I have run out of time. But the issue is that they have considered at different heights, for example, 1.5, 1.15 kilometers, 2 kilometers, 3 kilometers, 4 kilometers. This would be 4 kilometers if Nestor is done, or so on. So they are different shapes. But you see that the idea is essentially the following. The prompt flux is practically independent of the zenith angle, even underwater, right? The conventional flux is very dependent of the zenith angle. It decreases. So in different models, the crossing where you should see a change in a slope and so on will change with the zenith angle. For example, here you have seen that the crossover depends on lambda, using the models that we have made. This is GGV with, this is our models with lambda 0.1 or 0.5 at different heights. And you see that actually they cross differently. So you could use, and actually, you know, it is an experimental issue how much you can do in this. Different zenith angle dependence of prompt and conventional fluxes induces different depth dependence at the given zenith angle, and also produces different spectral shape at the given depth and zenith angle. Okay, so my conclusions, I will repeat them again. we suggest to use downgoing muons, which now are thrown out. If they are at all reconstructed, is to be able to throw them out. Even when they use cascades, sometimes they reconstruct the muons to throw them out. They don't use them. They don't keep them. Now, it used to be that actually for Amanda, the first Amanda B or so, they didn't have the capability of keeping them. There were too many. But now it's becoming possible at least to keep one in a million or one in 10 to the 5 or one in 10 to the 4. This changes. But in any case, it's possible. So I have proposed to or suggest to measure the slope or to say something about the PDF of the gluon, a small x, where the prompt muons dominate, the energy is above 100 TeV, and to measure the prompt atmospheric neutrino flux, which is the major background for the major signal in neutrino telescopes, which is cosmogenic neutrinos. At energy, so we're proposing to use downgoing muons to see the level of the atmospheric neutrinos because they are the same. And actually here, there is a nice quote in this paper by Hopper and so on. They have, you know, I said that this is the first real serious study of this issue. And they say other methods, and they refer to us, to measure the prompt neutrinos flux would be quite complementary to direct neutrino measurements. This method could simplify the problem of separating the prompt neutrino flux from other components significantly. And people at Amanda B are interested now. They're starting to see how far they can go with this. Okay.
Questions? Can you see prompt photons in Piaget?
Photons, I don't know, but what they could be seeing is are muon bundles. Actually, they use muon bundles, almost horizontal muon bundles, to calibrate their clocks. Their clocks, of course, have this positioning, global positioning system, but they have to check that actually the clocks are working well. And they use these muon bundles, very collimated muon bundles, and those actually may be due to, I don't know, this is something I have to see, because they don't see any asymmetry with the andas. So they must be energetic enough that you don't see the andas in the asymmetry. So there are things with this that could be seen in Pierre Auger. But I don't know about photons.
The shower front radius would be different.
You know, actually, none of these simulations, I was checking in IRIS, they don't include the charm. They don't include the charm. They don't have the charm production at the higher energy. So this is something that we could do. Maybe.
Any questions? Thanks,
Marcelo. Okay. Thank you.